So welcome back to another episode of Rebuilding the Palisades podcast hosted by DSI. I'm Zach Fagan. Today, we have the distinguished Ken Unger, of principal of Unger Architects. Welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
All righty. Well, I typically like to start, you know, just to, you know, find out a little bit about who you are. How did you get into architecture initially?
You'd have to go way back to when I was a little kid. I always knew I wanted to be an architect. I wanted to be a builder. And having a Jewish mother, she kind of encouraged me to be an architect instead of a builder. I always loved building things and constructing things and drawing things and designing things. It was always just a passion of mine that developed since a very young age. And I always knew I wanted to be an architect, and went to college and got my degree, undergraduate degree in architecture, and then went on to get a master's degree in architecture as well.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Where'd you go to school at?
Undergrad, Berkeley, graduate UCLA.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
California through and through.
Love that. Love that. I miss my Bay Area, actually.
Did you grow up there?
No, but my wife and I bought a house in Novato, and she worked in Berkeley for quite some time, and it's one of her favorite jobs. She just absolutely loved it. All the professors would come in. She was a stylist, and all the professors, you know, from Berkeley would come in and get their hair cut, and she would have awesome conversations, you know, with her clients. So, very, very cool. So you've designed over 300 custom homes. Many of them in the Palisades.
Yes.
I know this is going to be a hard one, but which one is your favorite or at least most notable that you've done throughout your career?
In the Palisades or just in general, houses I've designed over the years?
Let's limit it to the Palisades. What's your favorite project in the Palisades?
Well, I don't think it would be prudent for me to say. not to be political, but I've designed over the years so many houses there and so many different, amazing, wonderful clients that I would not want to single one of them out.
Sure, understood.
And you also have to know that over the years, my style or my design palette has evolved. So what I may have liked or what I may have been into 20 years ago, I wouldn't necessarily be into today. I think one of the important facets of being an architect and a good architect and a relevant architect is having the wherewithal to understand that style or design evolves, right? To be stuck in your ways of what you did 20 years ago, and still insist on doing the same thing today would be a mistake. I think it's important to evolve with the times. Yeah. So I've done, some interesting houses in the Palisades, some interesting houses in Brentwood and Santa Monica and Beverly Hills and all over the place. And many of them have been challenges and rewarding in different ways. So, it's really, I don't know that I can answer that question anyway, because I don't know that I would have a favorite. If I would say, some of the more interesting houses I've done over the years happen to not be in LA, because in a lot of ways, the city of LA has a set of building and zoning codes and local homeowners association codes that somewhat stymie creativity. So it's when I've been able to design outside of those areas in locations where A, you have a little bit more land to work with, and B, you have a little bit more flexibility on some of the code related issues. I'm not talking about life safety type stuff. I'm talking about more about design stuff. To have a little bit more freedom to do what you want to do has been nice in those locations.
That makes sense. Yeah. How about styles. Mm-hmm. You're known for a fairly specific style of building, right? Do you have a specific kind of, do you have a more favorable disposition toward any specific style of architecture, I guess? Let me put it that way.
No, I think that in some ways I've been sort of tagged with having a certain quote unquote style associated with my architectural practice. And the reality is over the years, I've developed a design philosophy whereby I really want to try and listen to my clients and what they want and take that into consideration when designing a house for them. There's a lot of architects out there who will only do modern, who will only do Spanish or something like that. To me, that's the wrong tack to take. I think the important thing is to listen to your clients, understand what they're looking for in terms of interior layout and exterior imagery. A lot of times they go together. And then assessing that along with the context. In other words, there's certain locations where you wouldn't do a certain style house. It just wouldn't belong.
Right.
You know, modern, I would say, belongs more in Malibu and or the hills of L.A. You go into the Palisades, as an example, many of the homeowners associations there won't allow modern. The Huntington
right.
doesn't really want it, and the Riviera doesn't really want it either, so you have to kind of work around it in order to get to that style. So that's why you see very few of those styles in those very few of that style in those locations. So because I would say a large majority of my work is in the Palisades, and many of those homeowners associations don't really want to see super modern houses, then yeah, some of my work there, most of my work there is on the more traditional side. Some of my houses in Santa Monica or elsewhere have been more modern. It just really depends on the context.
Sure. Well, that's a great segue into my next question. So your styles range from traditional to contemporary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd like to know kind of how do you determine the right style for each client and each site? You've kind of just answered some of that. It's going to depend on the homeowners association and obviously what the client's, you know, looking for. But talk a little bit more about kind of determining what type of architectural style is right for the specific site that the house is going to go on.
Right. Again, context is important. What's around it? Unfortunately, in the Palisades right now, there's not going to be a lot of context.
Right.
So what do you do in that particular case? Number one, you ask your clients, what do they envision? What would they like to see their house look like? And that is a big part of the equation. And then number two, you assess the location in terms of north, south, east, west. You don't want, if the front of the house is facing west, you don't want to overdo it with glazing there because then it's just going to get beat down with sun and it's going to be difficult to condition. So you take that into context. You take it's almost like a melting pot. You take all those different elements, the client's desire, the location, the direction the house is facing, and you kind of blend them together and you come up with something that works for everybody. And now when in the aftermath of the fire, a lot of the houses, not a lot, 100% of the houses I'm doing are going to be of non-combustible materials. We're also going to be eliminating certain details on the houses that we had before that I think were, I don't know that they exacerbated the fires, but they were not helpful, that's for sure. Some things like attic vents, we're eliminating attic vents. We're trying to eliminate eaves. You know what an eave is?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The eaves were noticeably trapping the heat. And to a point where it got so hot that the houses were almost blowing up. So I'm encouraging my clients not to have eaves. And we're using materials that are going to be not only non-combustible, but a little bit less busy in terms of detail, because especially when it comes to the roof, if you have a tile roof, even though the tile roof may be non-combustible, a tile roof has a lot of crevices, right? Nooks and crannies. And a lot of these embers were flying during the fire and embedding themselves in these quote-unquote non-combustible roofs to the point where they would eventually catch fire with what was underneath it or what was adjacent to it or something nearby. So I'm trying to encourage my clients to go with metal roofs in a lot of cases now, because metal roofs are a little bit more conducive to having these embers sort of hit them and kind of just slide off. So a metal roof now kind of lends itself to a little bit different style house, right? You're not going to put a metal roof on a Spanish style house, right? So the styles that I'm doing mostly now that you're going to be seeing going up very soon in the Palisades are going to be probably a little bit more on the transitional side. Transitional meaning we'll have the lines and the shapes and the masses maybe of a traditional house with the gables and the roof structure that the homeowners associations there like, but our details are going to be more streamlined to avoid the crevices, and as a result, the exterior style is going to be a little bit more transitional in appearance.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes sense. Yeah, I didn't think really so much about the point that you made about the nooks and crannies in the kind of terracotta clay. Yeah. That's just crevices just waiting to, you know, for a perfect home for embers to fly into and hang out there. So, to your point, you know, there's plywood right underneath it. There's, you know, combustible materials right there.
Right.
So, that's an important point. So over the years, you know, I know you've had just hundreds and hundreds of interactions with, you know, all kinds of different people. Yep. Over the years. It's a very wide variety of clientele that have historically lived, you know, in the Palisades. And it's probably difficult to kind of pin down, you know, specific interaction that you could point to as being, you know, maybe the highlight of your career in terms of interactions with customers. But could you talk a little bit about some of or maybe one particular client interaction that sticks out to you as just a joy, you know, to work with someone? You don't have to name the individual, of course, but, you know, a project that you look back on as you really, really fondly look back on as just a, you know, just a fantastic project and client interaction.
Well, I guess one of my houses in the Palisades immediately comes to mind. And my client in particular on that house was super supportive, confident, and appreciative of what I was bringing to the table. And that house is on Chautauqua and still standing. It survived the fires. So I would say most of my clients are super great people and supportive and appreciative. But I would say in particular, this one client really stands above the rest, and we still remain friends today. And I would say, as a segue to the rebuild effort in the Palisades, I'm finding that it's a joy to work with almost every single one of these people who lost their homes, because they are in a position that they never thought they'd be in, number one. And number two, they've lost so much. Many of these, you remember, the fires happened on a weekday, right? So many of these people were at work and nobody was home. And so they didn't get a chance to go back home and get anything.
Right.
So a lot of these people really only had what was the clothing on their back from that day. they had nothing, nothing left from their homes. And it really feels like I am helping rebuild their lives. And that's very meaningful to me. And to a person, every single one of them is so appreciative of the fact that I'm helping them create this new life that they're going to have, but that for the time being, this is really the most positive thing in their lives. And they really are enjoying it and appreciating the process and super positive and upbeat about it. So it's honestly, it's been a lot of work and it's super, super busy, but I don't mind because everybody is so great.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Being involved in something that, I mean, quite literally in some cases, might be saving folks from what would otherwise be a very depressing time in their life to help them rebuild. That's a very personal and touching thing, and definitely a gift to be a part of that.
Yeah.
Discover why we're the most awarded home technology firm in the U.S. Our design-centric approach transforms your space with effortless control of lighting, motorized shades, audio, video, and more. Our friendly experts guide you every step of the way, no tech speak, just smart, stunning simplicity. We provide years of care from our award-winning service and support team. Experience technology that feels as good as it looks.
So shifting gears a little bit, here at DSI, we get quite a few kind of crazy requests for, unique and, different types of applications, for technology. What are some of the, one of the wildest, kind of most outlandish things that a client ever asked you to do?
Taylor mentioned this. I was thinking about that question, and I would have to say I got a request for from a couple who'd been married a long time to adjacent or right next to their bedroom to have a snoring room. Not a big space, but something where I won't say who's the snorer, but where the snorer can get up and go and close the door and still be close to the spouse.
Right on.
And not bother them.
Yeah. I need one of those.
I think a lot of people, once they get past a certain age, it's interesting, and who've been married for many number of years are migrating to perhaps having at least separate bathrooms or separate bedrooms for one of those reasons, which is somebody snores or somebody has difficulty sleeping or has insomnia and they don't want to bother the other person.
Sure. Yeah, indeed. Well, this question, is a little, we'll just kind of take this one at face value. Let's do the best we can with it. Have you ever had a project or client relationship that just really didn't go as planned?
Doing this for 35 years, that does happen. But I've never been released from my duties on a job. I've never been involved in any lawsuits, knock on wood. I think which speaks volumes about my practice and my experiences over the years.
It does.
But yeah, some people are going to be more difficult than others, but it's never gotten to the point where we had to part ways.
That's awesome. I think there are very, very few in business that have been in business as long as you have, done as many projects as you have, that never had that, kind of terribly gone south project. That's definitely a big feather in your cap. That definitely says a lot about you and your firm, without doubt.
On the flip side, I have picked up many jobs over the years where other architects were not successful.
Indeed. Again, and that also says volumes about about your character and talent. So the Palisades Fire, obviously one of the most devastating disasters, you know, in LA history. In the aftermath of the fire, what was going through your mind initially, like as it was happening? What were you thinking?
Well, as it was actually happening, I was obviously, you know, contacting as many of my clients as I was in touch with, to, you know, and but unfortunately, nobody really had an initial idea of, you know, whether their houses were gone or not, because they just got out of there, and it was difficult to see and find out what was the status of their home. So obviously, initially, during the fires, I was very concerned for many of my clients, and their, you know, their family and or pets and whatever, what have you, that I wanted to make sure everybody was going to be safe. When it looked to be pretty clear that, you know, for some miraculous reason, I don't think there was a fatality, was there, from the Palisades fire? I think maybe in Altadena there was, but not in the Palisades.
I haven't heard of any fatalities in the Palisades.
That's pretty miraculous.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you think about it. So I think that is really the most important thing, that we didn't really have any loss of life. So clearly, initially, that was the most important thing that came to my mind. A house is a home, certainly, and a house, but a house can be rebuilt, and that's what I'm here for, to help them rebuild. And then, you know, when it became, you know, in the aftermath of the fire, after, you know, the dust started to settle, then it became, I kind of went into a different sort of mode, which was, okay, I'm up for the task, and I think I can manage to help many people. The question in my mind was, how is the city going to be, the building department? And I was very concerned about that, because they are a behemoth and slow to change, slow to adapt, and set in their ways, like any bureaucracy is. So fast forward a few months. Unfortunately, the city has not been up to the task, and it's been very frustrating. And I've reached out to many political and involved people with the city bureaucracy to kind of lodge my complaints, and some has helped, but much of it's gone on deaf ears.
Mm. Interesting. We've heard quite a bit about the overall effort of, you know, various individuals, committees, and kind of groups that are getting together to, you know, to just get a jump on this rebuilding process and figure out, you know, how's it going to work? How can we streamline it? How are we going to deal with logistics? And, you know, I'm hearing that there are going to be, you know, streets closed through Santa Monica and stuff like this. And, haven't heard a lot about what the city specifically is doing, other than kind of, you know, they're going to streamline some processes, and they've got some, you know, some people on staff, you know, at the plan check counter on the weekend, stuff like that. But you're right. It is a big bureaucracy, and there's a lot of folks there. And, like any bureaucracy that's set in its ways, you know, it's not very, you know, quick to change. So I think that'll be an ongoing, challenge without doubt. So kind of dovetailing on that, you know, the Palisades has a distinct character, a lot of different styles of homes in the Palisades, but it, as a whole, the community has a distinct character. It's a very unique, community in Southern California. It's unique, you know, as it relates to, you know, communities along the coast, the topography, the location, just all of it is definitely distinct. We touched on a little bit of this already, but, you know, talk a little bit more about what opportunities and constraints that you find designing homes specifically in the Palisades.
Well, the opportunity right now is that we pretty much have a clean slate. And I think that we can build a community and build a city. I mean, essentially, for for no uncertain terms, the Palisades is a city, and we lost a whole city. I think we can rebuild a whole city and rebuild it better than it was before. And the sense of community that's there, that everybody speaks about, that we all know about, I think will return, because that sense of community comes with the residents themselves.
Mm-hmm. You're right, the people.
And but from an architectural standpoint, I think we have an opportunity to create an example to the rest of at least the state, because obviously we have major fire issues in our state and the whole Western United States. We can create a community of homes that adapts to today's world of fire-related dangers. And I think that there's a lot of things that we're doing that are going to make that happen. And I think in 20 years, I think other cities up and down the state and across the Western United States are going to look to the Palisades and say, okay, here's what they did over there. We should do the same thing. And we're doing it voluntarily, right? Nobody's telling us we have to do it. Nobody's telling us that we have to put sprinklers on the roofs, right? But we're going to be putting sprinklers on the roofs. No one's telling us that we have to have no attic vents. It's almost the opposite. The city of LA is the one that told us we needed attic vents all these years. Mm-hmm. And we would argue, well, why? It's especially in the Palisades, which is a very temperate climate. You don't necessarily, it doesn't get super hot to the point where you need that those attic vents to dissipate heat. Why not just insulate the hell out of those attics to get them to be more in line with the rest of the house in terms of temperature, so you don't need to vent them, okay? So I think there's going to be a lot of things that everyone's going to look to us in 20 years and say, okay, here's what they did, and it's working.
Yeah. California, again, being ahead of the curve, right?
Yeah, not necessarily on purpose.
Yeah, for sure. So obviously, there were a lot of homes that you designed which were likely lost in the fire. We probably don't want to talk about how many. It probably kind of feels like a gut punch every time we think about the work that you've done that's gone now. But, you know, talking through kind of redesigning these homes, do you think you're going to be using some of the same, you know, kind of design elements from the original builds, or doing things differently where, let's say, customer A comes back to you and you've got this lot and, you know, you designed the house for them before. Do you see it more likely that you'll basically just go back to those plans from, you know, say 1990 or you know, whatever year the home was built and kind of, hey, let's just go ahead and rebuild what we had before because we loved our home. It was amazing. Or take that as an opportunity to kind of try to experiment with that site a bit and do something else with the lot.
That's a really good question. I can answer it by sort of giving you an example of one of the homes I'm redesigning right now. My client, when we designed the home originally, their kids were small. They were young, right? So it's a different phase of your life.
Indeed, yeah.
And we had, you know, a certain number of bedrooms. They wanted like a playroom. They, you know, sort of kid more, I wouldn't say kid friendly, but more conducive to a young family, the design of the house. So fast forward 15, 20 years, the kids are out of the house. And initially they came to me and said, well, Ken, I think we just really want to build what we had. It was a great house. You know, maybe make a few tweaks here and there. Maybe we want a gym or, you know, something like that now that we didn't have before. But for the most part, let's kind of just do what we had. We loved the house. So I started working on it. And then as the design was evolving, they were saying, well, you know what? We're in a different stage of our lives now. Yes, we love that house. But we don't need X, Y, and Z anymore. We don't need as big a house anymore. I have a lot of clients who are building smaller houses than they had. We want a house that's more adult-friendly. We want to entertain our friends. We want Yes, certainly we need a couple of bedrooms for when our kids come back home and things like that. But overall, I would say that a lot of people initially were probably thinking they would want to rebuild the same house, maybe with a few minor tweaks. But over time, that thought process has evolved because, as to be expected, they're in a different stage of life and they have different needs. A lot of people are older now. Maybe we designed the house when they're 40 and now they're 60 or 65. They want an elevator.
Very right? good point.
So they want the house to be handicap accessible. They want the house to have a room that in case, God forbid, they need a caretaker or somebody to live with them, they have that space for them. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of that going on also.
For sure. And to your point about, you know, designing something that's a little smaller mm-hmm. than it was, we've heard a lot about, you know, the insurance component here, yep. which, yep. you know, unfortunately, many of these homeowners didn't have enough coverage to really replace what they had there. Do you think that some of the kind of, you know, activity around downsizing, mm-hmm. as it were, mm-hmm. Has an insurance component there as well?
I say a certain percentage, yes. But my information is kind of somewhat biased because people are coming to me because they want to rebuild, right? I think I'm not hearing from the people in the alphabet streets who are stuck and can't afford to rebuild. They're not calling me, right? So my information is somewhat one-sided. I would say for the most part, the reasons for people to maybe build a smaller house is maybe because they don't need that space anymore. There is some, to some degree, there are cost implications and insurance coverage, but again, seemingly, at least from my perspective as an architect and the people that have been calling me, people were pretty well covered from an insurance perspective. It doesn't may not cover 100% of what they had, but don't forget the lot value over the years has increased greatly in value, so there's some worth in that, and they're using that to leverage to be able to rebuild.
Yeah, makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, and I guess technically, if you don't need that much conditioned space, now you can maybe have more, you know, grass in the backyard, right. for example.
Everyone wants a good sized yard, and that's always been important to me. And again, I would say, you know, the majority of the rebuilds that I'm doing are not necessarily old clients of mine. A lot of them are people who live down the street from a house I designed, or I designed their friend's house. And don't forget, a lot of these houses have changed ownership over the years too. So, interestingly enough, a lot of the houses that I'm rebuilding for people, they had postage stamp size backyards. And now that they're older and they want to spend more time outside entertaining or just being outside, they're like, you know what? The house was too big for the lot. We want to design a house that gives us our backyard back. So there's a lot of that going on too.
Yeah. And back when the house was designed and built in the first place, maybe the motives were different to the extent that they wanted to maximize the conditioned floor space. And that outdoor space didn't matter, you know, as
right.
much.
Well, if it was a developer, generally developers try and build as big as possible.
Right.
So if somebody had bought a house from a developer, maybe that was the case. And now they're like, my yard was too small. I want more space in the yard.
Yeah. Not great, great points. So, you know, working on a burned site mm-hmm. must be emotionally difficult, right? How are you kind of helping clients just start fresh?
It's emotionally difficult for them, obviously, because they lost their home and they had their personal belongings are gone. How do I help them recover emotionally? Is by getting them excited about their design. Mm-hmm. And it's really great when, you know, again, another client's popping into my head, you know, they were really, I wouldn't say depressed, but really upset after the fire. They didn't know where to go. They had to go find a new place to live. They had to develop a new community. They had to put their kids in a different school. Their whole lives were upended, right? So
yeah.
Initially after the fire, they weren't thinking primarily of, you know, rebuilding. They needed to get their lives situated. So now that we're involved in the redesign process of the house, it's like, and they're getting excited about it. And I'm telling them the other houses that I'm doing, maybe even on their street or around the corner, and how many we're doing and how many others are doing. And when you drive around the Palisades now and you see over 50% of the lots have already been, the debris has already been removed. It's pretty incredible. And, you know, I saw one house already under construction, and I'm about to pull three permits for new houses already. So I think that the spring, the return to the springtime feeling of renewal is happening. And I think from an emotional perspective, not to elongate my answer, but emotionally, for these people to have that back to what we talked about before, that positive element to their life of rebuilding and seeing the Palisades rebuild, I think is pretty uplifting.
Mm, indeed. Yeah, for sure. So look, with so many owners kind of rebuilding simultaneously, mm-hmm. do you think there's an opportunity here for architects to kind of, I'd say collaborate, but coordinate? Or just is there an opportunity for any of the stakeholders involved to kind of, you know, coordinate in a way to, you know, make the process more efficient? Or do you have thoughts on how the process could be done in a more efficient way? Is there like a way that we could do things in bulk, or, you know, like an economy of scale kind of, example that you could speak to?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's mostly more of a question for a contractor than an architect. I think the contractors are trying to consolidate their subcontractors and the material suppliers so that they can all kind of work together and make it as easy as possible. From an architectural standpoint, I think it's important almost not to do that. To me, one of the greatest things about the Palisades was the uniqueness of each home. As you drove down the street, every home was different. And I think that it's important, if the Palisades is going to come back better than it was before, that we maintain that uniqueness, that each house is different. I'm a little concerned, and I got a bunch of calls from developers initially after the fires. Hey, Ken, we're thinking of getting together, and we're going to get 100 homeowners together, and we want you to design three renditions of a house, let's say for the alphabet streets. And I thought about it, and I thought, I don't think that's what people want in the Palisades. I think people love the uniqueness. And I think that that element, if they come in and design 100 houses at a time and have three sort of cookie cutter type designs that they're going to use and choose from, I think is the opposite of what the Palisades is or the Palisades residents want. So I purposely kind of stayed away from that kind of thing. So I think, however, from a construction standpoint, for sure, I think they should make the alphabet street one way. I think you should only park on one side of the street in the alphabet streets. I think from a building department standpoint, there's a lot of things they can be doing to expedite the process that they're not doing, and I've suggested. For instance, if you take the alphabet streets, the codes in the alphabet streets, believe it or not, are a little bit different than the Huntington. Really? They're a little bit different than the Bluffs, yes. The zoning codes are slightly different. And that what the city, and I suggested this to the city, what they should have done is should have taken two or three engineers, plan checkers, and assigned them to the alphabet streets. So you get a consistent response, consistent plan check response, mm-hmm. as opposed to what's happening is if you submit a set of plans, if I took the same set of plans and submitted it to three different building departments, West LA, let's say, in Van Nuys and downtown, I would get three 100% different set of corrections mm-hmm. because there's no consistency. They should have consistency between the neighborhoods. Take three guys, assign them to the Huntington, three guys to the Alphabet Streets, three guys to the Bluffs. I think that would expedite the process. And I've suggested this to Rick Caruso and Tracy Park's office, and they all say, yeah, it makes sense. But the problem is, again, none of them really has control over the building department. and it's just sort of not happening. And at a certain point soon, it's, you know, it that ship has sailed.
Yeah. No, you make a great point. Whenever you take a set of plans to the desk,
yeah,
Nancy comes to the desk, and Nancy's going to have some thoughts and corrections for you, right? And you go and you get those corrections done, and you bring the plans back. Well, Nancy's not here today. Well, now you have John.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And John's going to go, well, that was dumb. You didn't have to do this, but you need to do this, this, and this. And now you have another set. And, okay, you go and you do those corrections and come back. Well, now it's Jack. And Jack has thoughts.
Or back to Nancy. Worse.
Yeah, so.
Why did you do this?
Yeah, having that consistency is, that would make a really measurable difference, I think.
For sure.
Across building departments.
Same with the inspectors.
100%.
You've been on job sites, right?
Oh, yeah.
One inspector will come out and say, oh, who let you do this? This is terrible.
Right.
And another guy go, why did he tell you to do that? There's no reason for you to do that.
Right.
It's like they have their different interpretations of the codes. And inspectors, you know, in fairness to them, their job is a little bit more difficult because they're on site and they have a limited amount of time on each job site. But there is a way to make the corrections and the responses from the billing department more consistent that they are really kind of missing the boat on.
Mm. Yeah, I started in the construction business when I was 15.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about 35 years of being on job sites. And I've worked on projects from all over the U.S., Miami, the Boston area, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and traveled for work in, you know, Monterey, Mexico, Chennai, India, Puerto Rico, et cetera. And building methods, procedures, materials, building codes, and inspection styles vary greatly. And they vary even here in Los Angeles to the extent that you may go back and forth on very, very small details that I wouldn't say are meaningless, but are inconsequential in the grand scheme of things, just because of that lack of consistency in a plan checker or an inspector. So, yeah, hopefully someone listens and is able to implement some of these ideas. That was a great idea. So, you know, obviously we've talked about a lot of different kind of challenges and things that we're all working through. And in your opinion, what are some of the biggest challenges that this community is facing right now in you know, kind of the rebuilding process and just all things associated with mm-hmm. where we're at right now? What do you think are some of the biggest challenges?
Well, I've mentioned the billing department already, so I won't harp on that anymore, but that's the initial one. I'm starting to get calls now from people who are a little bit concerned about the timing because there's going to be a bell curve of construction, right? Right now, if you're starting construction, you're going to be on the underside of that bell curve. But when we get to the middle of that bell curve, let's say in a year from now, and everybody's under construction, or at least 60% of the houses is under construction, how is that going to be managed? And what's going to happen for access for these contractors and subcontractors? Thankfully, I think because there's not a lot of neighbors anymore, hopefully they're going to let contractors come in at work at 6 in the morning and work till 6 at night or till dusk and let them get done more in a typical day than normally if there's neighbors around and they need their peace and quiet. Let them work on Saturdays. If there's no neighbors, why not? And I'm a little concerned about not so much general contractors, because I think the general contractors that I'm working with are limiting the amount of jobs they're taking, but the subcontractors I'm concerned about. I'm concerned that subcontractors might take on too much work and or decide at a certain point, you know what, I'm gonna jack up my price artificially because I'm in such high demand. Why not? So, and that's going to start jacking up people's overall construction price. So I'm a little concerned about that. I'm a little concerned about a lot of the Johnny-come-latelys in the Palisades that I see out there. And a lot of my clients are coming to me and say, hey, Ken, have you heard of this contractor or that contractor? And generally, if you've built anything in the Palisades as a general contractor, I've probably worked with you. But now all of a sudden I'm getting all these requests for me, if I know XYZ or contractor, and I don't know who they are, and I'm concerned that these guys are coming in and telling people things that are not accurate. Oh, I can build your house for X amount of dollars per square foot. Oh, Ken's telling you that? That's crazy. I can do it for a lot less. Maybe so, maybe not. And even if maybe so, I know it's not going to be the quality that at least I would be happy with. And I know most of my clients would be happy with, that you would be happy with. There's a lot of details in my houses that people appreciate over time. And I think a contractor who's coming in trying to woo people with false pretenses on costs are going to miss those things or attempt not to do them and get away with it. And then what happens?
Right. Yeah. Now you've got a complete misalignment of expectations and ultimately an unhappy customer.
Unhappy customer. Yeah. It's going to cost more than they expected. And it kind of goes back to one of my philosophies about getting houses built. I think it's important that your architect and your contractor have somewhat of a relationship and some experience of working together, because that's very important, because the contractors know what my expectations are and vice versa. And especially if they've built the house of mine before and gone through the process with me, they know what I'm expecting to see. They know what details that they need to execute and not forget about and not miss. So generally, if you work with an architect and a contractor that do have experience working together, the process is generally going to go a lot smoother than if you have somebody new who comes in and promises things that knowingly can't be met, and then all of a sudden starts to point the fingers elsewhere and say, oh, well, I didn't see that in the plans, or that detail was hidden in a place that nobody ever looks, or things like that. It just creates animosity, which is not prudent for the process.
No, we don't need any more heartburn in the design build process, do we?
No.
Well, that's great feedback. Ken, look, again, thank you very much for coming in. This has been fantastic.
Thanks for having me. Been fun.
Conversation. And look, we look forward to seeing you again soon.
We'll see you out on the job sites for sure.
Real good. All right. Thank you very
much. Thanks for having me.